Welcome everyone to episode 6 of the Real MVP podcast, and I'm your host, Modern Vintage Gamer. Now, this month I have a very special announcement. I was in attendance as a guest speaker at the Long Island Retro Expo over the weekend from August 10 to 11 in Long Island in New York, and it was an awesome show. I had so much fun, and I had my first panel at the show, which was the history of copy protection. And a lot of people have asked me, was there any audio or video capture of that particular panel that I did at the show? And the answer is yes, there is. I was fortunate enough to get the whole entire panel recorded, and I'm going to be playing it back for you guys on this show. So sit back and enjoy the history of copy protection at the Long Island Retro Expo, and I'll catch you guys next month. Last panel of the day, but the best panel of the day, right? Which one was the best one? Well, hey, thank you so much, everyone, for coming to my panel. This is my first time in Long Island, so I'm really psyched to be here. The show is fantastic, so I'm really, really psyched to do my panel here. Let me go through my slides here. So who am I? For those people that don't know, my name is Modern Vintage Gamer on YouTube. I'm on all social media. So just Google me, you'll find me. I've got history in homebrew and emulation development, and I've done stuff on the OG Xbox, PSP, Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and recently the Nintendo Switch. I ported Doom to the Switch in 45 minutes. That's one of my trivia things I like to tell people. And I recently ported Diablo to the Switch, which got a lot of media attention as well. So I'm very much in the development stuff that's going on with the homebrew underground scene, and I really, really enjoy doing that stuff. But like everything, how did I get my start? Well, the first computer I ever bought back in the 80s, well, I didn't buy it, my dad brought it home, of course, was a Commodore VIC-20. And that computer really, really changed my life. But when you turn the computer on, that's what you get. You get a blinking cursor. So, you know, what do you go from here? But one thing that I'd noticed that my father had bought with the package was a tape drive. Now, I was born in Australia, and tape drives were very, very popular. They were cheap. They cost like $40. So there was really no other option. The disk drives were just way too expensive at the time. So, of course, to get games to run, that you need to buy these cassettes. And when I was a kid, you know, I didn't even know that you could buy games on cassette. So I kind of hung out with the nerds at school that had Commodore VIC-20s as well, and all of them were swapping games with each other. And I thought, hey, I want to get in on this, but how do I do it? Well, the answer to that is just use something like this, right, which is a tape-to-tape recorder which had back in the 80s. And this was really the first, I guess, you know, thing that I used to copy cassettes with games. And after that happened, then we moved over to the Commodore 64 a few years later, which is one of my favorite computers, by the way, one of the best 8-bit machines ever. And one thing I noticed was we started, you know, copying games the same way we did the VIC-20 stuff, which worked fine for a while. But then one thing happened. I noticed that I was getting these load errors. And by the way, for those people that can tell, that's actually a Sinclair Spectrum error screen, not a Commodore 64. I just ripped it off the internet. But anyway, you get the point. So I was getting these load errors when I was copying these tapes, and I'm like, well, how is that even possible? And what I found out was the game development companies started to master the cassettes, and they had very, very weak signals in order to prevent kind of just, you know, regular tape-to-tape duplication. So I would sit there and try to, you know, record a game, and it would never work. It would work maybe one in like 10 times or something. So that was really the first, in my experience at least, a copy of protection that I've ever been, you know, aware of that happened. It happened back in those days, even before disk drives even were a thing. And it's still possible to record a copy with a decent tape deck, you know, with some EQ to boost the mid-range and good quality cassettes, but it was really crude early copy protection. You know, the development houses really knew what was going on. They wanted to stop the duplication of cassettes, and this is one of the things that they did. I mean, obviously, it's really difficult to not copy a cassette, but these are some of the tricks that they used in order to do that, and it was quite effective, especially to stop the, I guess, the schoolyard or the backyard copying that was going on at the time. But when we talk about disk drives were completely different. Disk drives, these big bulking disk drives, the Commodore 1541 and the 1050 and the Apple II drives, they essentially had computers built into them. Most of them have 6502s installed in them. So the 1541 has a 6510 CPU. And so these things were a lot more advanced than the cassettes, obviously. And again, disk hopping was a real big problem. So some of the tricks that they used were intentional disk errors. So in other words, they would actually put errors on the disk. So if you made a copy of the disk and it had no errors on it, then they knew it was a copy, so it wouldn't work. And one of the easiest way to intentionally have a disk error is to literally punch a hole on the disk and just, you know, punch a notch out of it. And that's what they did with some of the games. They also did other things where they would extend the track. So a track on a disk is a complete revolution around the disk is a certain track. And there's usually, if I'm thinking about like something like the Amiga, there's like 40 tracks per side. Each side, you know, there's 40 tracks. And then there's sectors, which is a division of those tracks. So there's like 8 sectors per track. I'm getting a little technical, but you get the idea. So they would do things like add long tracks or add long sectors or add extra tracks to the disk. So if it was a 40-track disk, they would sometimes add 42 tracks. And those types of things were very, very difficult to copy, but they weren't difficult to master. So in the mastering plant, you know, very expensive disk mastering equipment, you could easily get away with doing things like that. So that everything that they were doing was kind of non-standard type stuff. And there's also weak and fuzzy bits. Now, that's something I'll come back to in a couple of slides because that's an interesting one. And then there was also these kind of protection methods that were coming out with games like Bounty Blob Strikes Back, if anyone's familiar with that game, called Spyro Disk. But if we're talking about copy protection, there were some real, really bad ones. And I'm going to talk about a few examples that I'm familiar with. And there's probably more, but these are the ones that I really thought about that were just awful. And the first one here is the lens lock. Does anyone know what the lens lock is? I'm sure some people do. Anyone? Any hands in the air? No? No one? Okay, so the lens lock was something that came out in the days of the Commodore 64 in the UK. And basically what this device is, first of all, it comes with this list of instructions in order to figure out how to use this thing. So that's what we're dealing with here. You have to basically read the manual in order to figure out how to use the lens lock. But essentially what you would do is you would hold this prism thing up to your CRT, and the first thing you would have to do is calibrate it. So you couldn't even use it. You have to, the words OK actually printed up on the screen here. So you would have to use the cursor keys left and right in order to calibrate the words OK. And once it was calibrated, then you would press the space bar, and then there would be a random two letter characters that come out that you'd have to type in order to defeat it. So it was extremely annoying and extremely frustrating. It was just a row of prisms that's cased in plastic. Only 10 games ever used it. You had to calibrate it, and one of the frustrating things was sometimes you would get the wrong lens for the wrong game, which means that you were screwed. I mean, there was nothing you could do, you know, take the game back maybe, or, you know. So you can see why, you know, software piracy was so kind of appealing at the time. The games were easy to crack, and the protection was pointless and frustrating, you know, in the end. And then we get into things like code wheels. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the code wheels. They first came out with the LucasArts games, SSI, the Gold Box games that came out. But the code wheel was also kind of frustrating as well. You know, you would have two or three kind of circular rings, and you'd have to match up the character on each of them, and then type in the corresponding thing in the middle there. It was better than the lens lock, but you know, it was also something that was easily reproducible as well. If you're willing to take apart your code wheel, and a lot of people were, then you could just photocopy each of them and then just kind of replicate the code wheel. Again, it was easy to crack, you know, frustrating, pointless, as per normal. And the next one is code sheets. Now, this is where things get really, really messed up. So the code sheets were just a variation of the same thing, the manual protection. The first one on the left there is, I don't know which game it's from, but it's basically type in the four characters from section 7, column 1, and row D. As you can see, it's something that they made very difficult to photocopy back in those days because, you know, photocopiers back those days. They weren't very good as far as, you know, DPI and stuff like that. The second one is a color protection that came with Jet Set Willy. So type in the corresponding color in, you know, row C, section 3. And I can't tell you how annoying this is, because, you know, people are colorblind, people don't see the right color sometimes. I mean, it's almost, you know, insulting that you would get something like this in order to get through the game that you've already purchased. So, but of course, 8-bit was cool, but 16-bit was where things got really, really interesting. And I was a Commodore Amiga guy, and the Amiga was pirate heaven. You know, I was doing schoolyard copying. We would copy games. We would go to copy parties and literally just swap games and play games. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, piracy is one of the things that is blamed for the demise of the Amiga and the 16-bit machines. And there was even copy programs that would crack games for you. So this is XCopy. It's very, very famous. You put your original game in. If it was a game that had the appropriate protection in there, it would just patch it out and make a copy for you. It was pretty awesome. This was a tool that many, many people used back in those days. But then we got smarter with something called copy lock protection. This was developed by a gentleman called Rob Northern. He was based in the UK, and he actually came up with a protection method across the Amiga, ST, and MS-DOS, and I think he did over 2,000 games. And essentially what his protection did was, he had a 32-bit key, which was unique to each game, that was obfuscated in a long sector, as I kind of mentioned before. So floppy drives can easily read the sector, but they can't write it back without expensive mastering equipment. So it was a fairly good copy protection method. And it stopped the casual copying, but it didn't really stop the, you know, the hardcore cracking groups. And some of the tools that they used in order to defeat that protection was what's called a freezer cartridge. And this is the action replay. This is by Daytel. And Daytel did a lot of things like this. So a freezer cartridge is basically when you're playing through a game and then you press the freezer button on the cartridge and it just completely freezes the game. And then you have access to all the memory, the registers. You can literally step through the code. You can rip sprites. You can rip the music. I mean, this thing is a hacker's dream, basically, the action replay cartridge. If you want to get into hacking, even today, if you want to go back and learn how these things were done, you want to learn how to crack games, this is what you need. This is, you know, a part of your arsenal for sure. And of course, you know, it wasn't very long before the crackers removed that Rob Northern protection from those Amiga games. And, you know, they would put their little crack throws in to rub it in as well, you know, that they'd beaten the protection, just to really kind of rub it into, you know, the game developers that they beat their protection in about a couple of hours. So piracy was a huge problem on the Amiga, the ST and MS-DOS, and many companies tried many different methods, and most of them quite honestly failed. Another one that really comes to mind is RoboCop. This one had a dongle that you would plug into the joystick port, and this particular one was, I talked to a guy that was in the group Fairlight, and Fairlight was a very well-known cracking group in the 90s, and he basically told me it took about 4 hours for them to completely remove it from the game. It was completely, it was pointless. Ocean Software that developed the game said that they weren't looking for a way just to stop piracy, but they were trying to mitigate it as best they could. But in the end, they kind of failed, unfortunately for them. But I've always said, and I think a lot of people agree, that the best way to mitigate this stuff is to really convince the pirate that they've cracked the game when they really haven't cracked the game. And there's a couple of really good examples of this. And I did a video on this, and some of you have probably seen this one already, but Dungeon Master is probably the first real example of that, where there were two levels of copy protection on the game, and everyone kind of went one way, but they really should have been going the other way. And let me explain what that is. So there was an unreadable sector on the disk that had data on there, but there was also fuzzy and weak bit protection, which I'll explain here shortly. So the crackers removed the fuzzy sector unreadable sector out of the disk, and they cracked the protection. Well, they thought they cracked the protection. So they did their intros and all that stuff, and they beated their chest and said, yep, we've cracked the game. But what they didn't think about was the fuzzy bit protection, which basically is a bit on a disk which can either be a 1 or it can be a 0. So if you put the disk in the drive and load it, It might read a 1 four times, but it might read a 0 six times. And the game Dungeon Master has this check about 9 times in the game. And basically, the way it checks it is if it always returns the same result, then it knows it's a copied game. It's not the original. So, you know, that's the way it works. And so if so as you play through the game, what would happen is everything seemed to be normal. You know, they cracked the game, but this fuzzy bit protection was still in place. And after a few hours, and it's a random dice roll, so it could happen like in 10 minutes, it could happen in like 4 hours. You could almost play through the entire game and then, you know, get to almost to the end, but you would get some weird behavior. And things like you would throw your weapons into the air, or you use the throwing weapon, and they would just stay suspended in the air. Doors wouldn't open, doors wouldn't close, you couldn't fight, you couldn't move, just all sorts of stuff, really just to annoy the player. And this protection actually took one whole year to completely remove from the game. And so this is one way that the game developers really came up with ingenious ways to beat protection, to give the sense that, hey, you know, you've cracked my game, when you really haven't cracked the game. And there's other examples of that that I'm going to kind of get to as well. So we talked about computers, and computers are cool, but what about game consoles, right? So game consoles, you know, there's a lot to cover here. And let me just grab a drink of water here real quick. If anyone's got a question they want to ask before I move on, please feel free to ask, by the way. Okay, let's move on. So game consoles, the 10NES is the lockout chip that came out with the Nintendo. It took 20 years to reverse engineer. Now, you could probably say, well, you know, you can just disable the chip. You can disable the chip, and that's what a lot of people did with the 10NES, but it took that much time to actually figure out what the code was doing, and you know, that's pretty awesome. And it was used also in the Super Nintendo as well as the Nintendo 64, the same chip. And then we had disc copiers on the Super Nintendo, and this is the Super Wild Card, I believe. I had a disc copier for a while, but I kind of felt like they were a little too clunky, and they didn't really work as good as they were advertised. But you can see it's basically a cartridge with a disc drive installed into it, and it basically allows you to just rip the game, and that's what they were used for. But the problem with these disc copiers were some games could detect that a copier was installed and you were playing a backup. Like, this is Donkey Kong Country, I think it's 3, I believe. It's easier to check if a disc copier, it's easier to check if a disc copier is being used, because of the large SRAM. So SRAM is the save game RAM that's used. The disc copier needs a lot of SRAM. So if the SRAM doesn't match what the game is, then, you know, a screen like this would come up. Now we talk about Earthbound. This was interesting. So Earthbound actually had 4 layers of protection. It had region protection, which was pretty common. Most games back then were, you know, not region free, of course. And then there was the copier protection that I just talked about. And if 1 and 2 were circumvented, but they were still being detected, you would get weird behavior in the game, like increased encounters. And it got really, really annoying to the point where you can almost, you know, not play the game. And then the 4th one is save file deletion. It would actually wipe your save file. So it would let you play through the game again. The encounters would get really annoying. Everything seemed to be cool, but when you went to save your game, it would get wiped. And that was Nintendo's way of handling it. And then moving on to the Genesis, TMSS, you've probably seen this screen many, many times. It's just the trademark screen that they have. And this is a trademark that appears in various memory locations. And this was used for their protection as well. And one of the games that comes to mind is Landstalker. Same kind of thing. It would erase the progress when you would save and reset your Genesis. I've got a little GIF here of him saving the game and resetting the Genesis there. But things got interesting with CDs. When we talk about CDs, things got really, really interesting. You could easily copy a PlayStation 1 disc. That's not a problem. You put it into a PC and you could read all the files off of it. You can make a copy of it. But the problem is each disc was mastered with a wobble groove. Basically, a couple of the grooves on the disc, when they were burnt, had this kind of sine wave pattern wobble to them. And that was the protection the PlayStation 1 had. And you may know the story about Spyro the Dragon, where you can play through the game on a backup, but eventually you're going to get to a point where it says, you may be playing a hacked copy of this game. And that was one of the things that they did. It was that protection where it felt like everything was okay, but then eventually this screen would come up. And after that would happen, you would get annoying things happening in the game, almost to the point where it was unplayable. Now, I've heard stories about people being able to beat the game with a hacked version of it, but I've never seen that, you know, myself personally, but I think that would be almost impossible to do. And then there's the PlayStation 2, which really took the PlayStation 1 to the next level. And this is an interesting story. So the PlayStation 2 had the wobble groove approach as well, but it also had more. The PlayStation 2 logo, when you put in a PS2 game, and it does that PlayStation, you know, comes up with a PS2 logo, goes whoop, like that. That logo is actually on each PlayStation disc. It's not on the console. So the disc has the logo, and the logo is encrypted on the disc. And in order to decrypt the logo, you need to get the key to decrypt the logo from the product code, which is also on the disc. But in order to get the product code, you have to get the decryption key for that inside the wobble sectors. So there was kind of two layers of additional protection on top of the watermark, or the wobble, as it's called. But of course, you know, the PlayStation 2 was heavily modded, so that really didn't make too much of a difference, especially with the mod chips that came out for it. But one really interesting story about the PS2 is the Action Replay. Now, you guys have probably seen this before, the Action Replay disc, where you would put the disc in, you'd load it up, you'd pick a game that you wanted to cheat on or get unlimited lives on or whatever, and then you would put the original disc in, and then you'd play the game with the cheats on. But the question is, this Action Replay 2 disc is 100% unofficial. It's unlicensed. So how is this possible? How can this disc actually boot in a PlayStation 2? And one of the things that I recently found out about, and I did a video on this as well, but I didn't have that information on hand, and I kind of wish I had waited a little bit, but I talked to someone that was very close to the Daytel, the Fire International people that developed this. And what they actually did was they took Crazy Taxi on the PlayStation 2 and they physically cut out the sectors and the wobble grooves from an original game and stuck it on their disc, and it worked. True story. And you know, they, once they tested that approach, they refined the process and they released their Action Replay discs. Now, you probably think, who is this guy on stage, you know, saying these ridiculous stories? But if you put an Action Replay disc or a Exploder disc in a PC, it's going to show up, the volume is going to show up as Crazy Taxi. Now, the reason why they use Crazy Taxi was because it had a large table of contents on the disc. In other words, it had a lot of files. It was easier to basically remove those sectors physically from an original Crazy Taxi disc. So Crazy Taxi is probably one of the most sacrificed PlayStation 2 games out there, because every time you see an Action Replay disc, it's actually being cut out from the sectors from a Crazy Taxi disc. And they used sophisticated cutting tools to replace the sectors, and it worked. It actually worked, and Sony was not happy. Not happy at all, as you can imagine. So, the Dreamcast. A lot of people believe the Dreamcast has no copy protection, but it actually does. I mean, GD-ROMs, think about it, right? Every Dreamcast disc is a GD-ROM, and you can't read that in a disc, in a PC. Well, you can now with hacked firmwares and stuff, but back in those days, they were unreadable. There was no way you could make a copy of them, so it absolutely had copy protection. The problem was, there was an exploit found in the MIL-CD format. The MIL-CD was a variant of these kind of media discs. I don't want to say karaoke, because they weren't karaoke, but you had, like, if you bought like Space Channel 5, you could get this add-on disc that had, you know, photos and music and stuff like that on there. And that was just a CD in what's called the MIL-CD format. But that particular format was also bootable on the Dreamcast. So essentially what the hackers did was they found the exploit in the MIL-CD and they took the same boot process from a MIL-CD and applied it just to a regular CDR. And that's how you can easily boot copied or backup CDRs on a Dreamcast without a mod chip. It's pretty simple to do. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people do believe that the Dreamcast is not, you know, there's no copy protection, but that is not actually the case. Moving on to the GameCube. This one is interesting as well. GameCube uses a mini DVD format, and it was mastered with BCA, which is the burst coding algorithm that they have. It's basically encrypted data, or burst cutting area, I should say. It's encrypted data, and there's six markings. You can see there's two of them I've kind of labeled there in red. So there's like little markings on the disk. So when you put this disk in the PC, it doesn't even detect there's a disk in the drive. It's completely unreadable. And then Daytel, again, were able to defeat this protection. So again, how do they do this? How does Daytel keep coming up with these action replay disks that keep somehow booting on original hardware without a mod chip? Essentially what they did this time, they didn't do anything as crazy as Crazy Taxi this time. It was a lot more straightforward. But essentially, with a modded GameCube, they were able to capture each of the challenge response calls that were going back and forth between the disk and the console, capturing all the challenge responses, and essentially just emulating that same process without the need of DVD mastering. So once they figured out the calls that were going back and forth, they just applied that to their disk, and it booted. So an action replay disk doesn't have any of the BCA at all. It's just a mini DVD that you would buy from the store at the time. So that was another way that Daytel got really smart and beat the GameCube copy protection. The OG Xbox, my favorite console. It has two partitions on there. It has the movie data, which is partition one. You're probably aware of this. You put a disc in the drive, plays a little movie or something. It says this is an Xbox game disc. And then there's partition two, which is the game data. Partition two is only unlocked during authentication on a real Xbox. So when you put the disc in a PC, again, it plays this movie. You've probably seen that before if you've tried. Even with a 360, Xbox 360 disc, it's exactly the same. You'll get something similar. But with a custom firmware, it's pretty easy to mount partition two and rip those discs on a PC. And this is what the release groups were doing. They weren't even using Xboxes at all. Because you can easily use a modded Xbox to rip a game. That's not difficult to do. A lot of people have done that. But this was a lot faster because it took the Xbox out of the equation, and you could have a really fast machine with, you know, at the time, probably like a 40-speed, DVD reader or something, or ripper that you could rip the disc very, very quickly. And a couple of little trivia points here at the end that I wanted to kind of talk about. The Sega Saturn took over 20 years to defeat. Now, I didn't really talk about much with it. Well, I haven't said anything about the Sega Saturn. I'm actually going through the process now of investigating that because I'm still a little unclear about what the protection is. I know there's DRM in there, but, you know, what it actually does and how it works. The Nintendo, the NES, the Super Nintendo, and the N64 all use the CIC chip. I kind of mentioned that before. And the last thing here is there's no copy protection at all on Sega CD, 3DO, Amiga CD 32, and Philips CDI. And there's probably more that I can add to that list, but that's really the crux of that with those CD-based games. And that's my presentation. Now, before we kind of wrap up, I really want to open up the floor. Like, I want to make sure everyone gets their questions in and wants to know stuff. I left plenty of time for questions, so if anyone has any questions, just raise your hand and I'll try to get to you. You're in the front there.
Did they ever track the losses from these piracies, or is it like an estimate?
So the question was, did they ever track losses from piracy? Yes, they did. I don't know the numbers, but I heard all sorts of stories about, you know, millions and millions of dollars being lost with different companies. But that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's probably worth taking a look at, because a lot of companies blame piracy for the demise of, like, a lot of people say that piracy killed the Dreamcast. I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, it certainly didn't hurt. It certainly didn't help, but I also feel like, you know, there was more to it that was going on at the time with Sega than just piracy, you know, killing off the Dreamcast. So, but it's a good question. You there?
Because of the Dreamcast, you bring it up, there was three revisions, 0, 1, and 2.
Yep.
Obviously, 0 and 1 could play burned this, but 2 wasn't able to.
Yeah.
What did they change that all of a sudden 2 wasn't able to do?
So the question is, the Dreamcast had three revisions, 0, 1, and 2. 0 and 1 had no protection in there, and 2 did. Essentially, they patched the MIL CD. So they completely removed the ability to use the MIL CDs in the revision 2. So they just completely took it away. And once they got to that point, you were left with, you know, GD-ROMs again. So that was your only recourse at that point. So.
Why was the Xbox your favorite console?
The question was, why was the Xbox my favorite console? It's a good question. I don't know. Like when it was announced, and I saw Halo for the first time, I just thought, this is it. This is the system that I've always wanted. I think a lot of it has to do with it's also a PC in a console. And I mean, nowadays we think about the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One, which is essentially just PCs. But back in those days, it seemed like it was different than everything else that was going on. And it felt like I connected to that machine more than I did with like the PlayStation 2. Or, you know, what was going on at Nintendo at the time. So I think that's my answer there.
I wanted to say I remember punching holes in a disc, too, back in the old I wanted to ask about EA and Sega, with the Genesis in particular. Why did they need to use that yellow tab on their cartridges? Like, what was the idea? I think it was to circumvent, was it?
It was. So the question was the EA cartridges that came out that had the yellow tabs. That's a good question. I need to look at it a little further. I kind of feel like it was more of an identification thing, but I also do know there was something to do with protection as well on those cartridges. But yeah, I mean, I'll definitely take that away and think about that a little bit, because I'm always looking for new and interesting stories to tell. So yeah, if there's a story there, I'll definitely look into it for you, for sure. You at the back there with your hand up.
What was the most malicious form of copy protection you've seen?
Oh, that's a good... So the question was the most malicious form. I mean, I think the save game removal stuff is pretty malicious. I mean, it's probably warranted. I mean, you know, Nintendo certainly doesn't want, you know, replicate or duplicates of Earthbound being played, but anytime you really, you know, mess with someone's computer or... yeah, something like that. I think that's, you're getting to the point where it's becoming more of, it's almost malware at that point, really, than protection. So I would say something that removes, takes away something from what you have is probably the most malicious. You there?
Do you know if Daytel is still around? Because it's pretty interesting the lengths they went to, like, to make a cheat code disk.
So the question is Daytel still around? I think so. I mean, you can still buy those Action Replay discs, and like you can still buy those like cheat code junky things. You can buy the SD card things for the GameCube where you can boot Homebrew from. So I think the answer is yes. I don't know if it's the same Daytel, but it, you know, it's still. I guess they're still there in some capacity. So. I think, honestly, right now, I mean, there's things like Denuvo and stuff that's out now, which I haven't really covered because it's kind of modern stuff, but I think the future of copy protection really is more, and I hate to say this, but it's more the games as a service type stuff, you know, like you have to be logged in to play the game, you know what I mean? So they're almost taking the protection out, because the only way to play the game is to be logged in all the time. So I think the whole games as a service model is really what is, you know, is their answer to that in so many ways. You know, if you're not connected, you're not playing the game, and that's really, you know, what it comes down to.
Is it possible to mod anything for the Xbox One or PS4 yet?
The question was, is it possible to mod anything for the Xbox One and PS4? PS4, yes, there are things you can do. Xbox One, no, not at the moment, at least as far as I know, so... Hopefully, there will be.
Kind of similar to that, do you think that the emulators games and 360 games on the Xbox One could ever be cracked to import ISOs?
The question was, do you ever think that the emulators for the Xbox One could be cracked to import ISOs? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've already seen some of those things happen. Like Parappa the Rapper on the PlayStation 4 had the ability to, had like a PSP emulator built into it or something. So there's always, developers always, not always, but there's, I always hear stories about something on the disk, some files on the disk that get left behind, you know, to leave some way to get, for a hacker to get in and you know, access something that they shouldn't be doing. Like for example, last week, Metal Wolf Chaos came out for the PC. And the original Xbox game is actually on the disk. And you can actually, if you have a modded Xbox, you can copy those files onto your Xbox and play Metal Wolf Chaos for free, right, on the Xbox. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they do. And they did remove it later on. So I noticed that Steam had an update, like 2 hours later, they removed them out. But there's always things like that happen. There's always traces of old stuff or debug files or symbols files or something that, you know, makes a hacker interested in, oh, I'm going to see if I can, you know, run some stuff on this game, which I shouldn't be doing, so. You.
I just realized that during your panel, you didn't touch on, like, the handheld part of gaming when it comes to copy protection and stuff.
So the question was about the handhelds, copy protection. There absolutely is protection. There's region protection on Game Boy Advance and Game Boy games and things like that. It's probably a subject that I need to get more into to understand better because but there's definitely a lot of stuff going on there with handhelds for sure. That's a really good question. It depends on what I'm working on. If there's a good emulator for the target platform, I'm gonna work on an emulator first, and then I'll test it on real hardware. That's a great question, but that's how I essentially do it. So for the Switch, for example, I actually use an emulator to test everything, and then once I feel comfortable that it's in a good spot, then I'll copy it over to real hardware and test it out. And it's really just for convenience on it more than anything else. You there.
Could you tell us a little more about like how you got Doom onto the Switch?
It's a good... I made a video on it, so...
Now I need to sign into a Bethesda account.
What's that?
So now I need to sign into a Bethesda account. Bethesda account?
Oh, no, that's the Doom on the DRM Doom. That's not. We don't want to talk about that in this room. So Doom on the Switch. How did I do it? Well, first of all, you need a modded Switch to do it, right? So if you don't have one, then there's no way you can do it. But there's some really, really good homebrew development tools out there. So there's a particular piece of development kit called the DevKit Pro, and it supports Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, GP32, DS, GameCube, Nintendo Wii, Wii U, and the Switch. So I downloaded the DevKit Pro homebrew, set it all up, and the way that I normally do things is if I'm going to start something new, I'm going to start really simple. So I'm going to do like a Hello World program and go from there. If I can get that to work, then the next thing I'm going to do is, okay, now can I get like the letter A to render on the screen? Yep, that's great. Then I'm going to see if I can get some bitmap graphics to display. Yep, that works. So from there, once I get really familiar with, you know, the environment, then I'll download a copy of the source code for something and have a stab at trying to port it. Now, the thing about Doom has been ported on everything. Like, it runs on microwaves, toasters, refrigerators, watches. I mean, it's so portable, and it's so easy to port. So I thought, well, there's probably a way to make this work. And I'm pretty familiar with the code anyway. So it was pretty easy to do in the end. You there.
What's your favorite console besides the original Xbox?
My favorite console besides the original Xbox? Ooh, probably the Super NES is probably number two. Yeah. You there.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about the web being a place for running emulation with the advanced WebAssembly and the Inscriptance compiler. So, like, you'd be able to basically take probably a lot of your old source code in
yep.
C++ port that to a web. Have you thought about something like that?
I have. So the question was about, you know, emulation on the web, in a browser, I'm assuming, yeah. And have I considered doing that? I will say it's definitely interesting. Like, I'm all about emulation. Like, anywhere we can emulate, I think, is a good thing. So, you know, in a browser is fantastic to do. For me, it's not really that interesting because, I mean, I'd rather do it on some exotic hardware than in a browser. But that's just my opinion. But I do think a lot of that is starting to crop up more and more these days. Like, for example, you know, there's so many things you can run in a browser now. You can run, like, DOS games, and you can run, you know, all sorts of stuff in a browser, which is fantastic. So I do think there is, you know, more to come there. And it may be something I may take a look at for sure. There's definitely some appeal there. But like I said, I'd rather just, you know, use some exotic hardware to do it instead.
When you move over here overseas, did you bring your consoles with you? And what did you have to, like, do to, like, get them to work here, signal-wise or power-wise?
Yeah, so the question was, when I came over here from overseas, did I bring my consoles with me? So first of all, just to let everyone know, I live in Kansas City. I'm a U.S. citizen, so let's get that out of the way first. I was born in Australia, and I moved over here many years ago. But I did bring some stuff with me. So, you know, some of the things, so I brought like an Amiga 3000, which has 240 volts instead of 110. So what I usually do in that situation is I'll buy a replacement power supply and swap it, you know, swap the power supplies. I'll keep the original, of course, but, you know, otherwise you're using like step-down converters and stuff like that, which I'm not really a big fan of. So I'd rather just get the appropriate power supply for the right country and do that.
Did any like the big companies come down hard on the people who are trying to break the copy protection?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some court cases out there, you know, Atari versus Nintendo, that we kind of talked about with the 10 NES. So Atari basically ripped off the code for the 10 NES chip. They basically stole the source code. So they went into the patents office and requested it, and they got it. And they got sued and they lost. The other one was Sega versus Accolade. There was a big thing that happened there with Accolade. So there's definitely some examples of you know, legal disputes and legal cases that have occurred in video games for sure. You at the back in the blue.
So I'm curious, how do you prevent, like with your modded Switch, prevent Nintendo from downloading its system update? Because I know Nintendo tends to be pretty aggressive.
Yeah, so the question is, how do I keep my modded Switch out of Nintendo's interesting prying hands? The question is, the answer is airplane mode. Just leave it in airplane mode all the time. I don't even consider trying to connect to the eShop on it. There's no point. So I have two Switches. I'll have just a regular one, which I use with, you know, with the eShop and regular games. And the homebrew stuff, I just keep offline, essentially. And I think that applies to anything. I mean, if you want to buy anything that's modded, that is connected to some service that is still running, then I would suggest, you know, keep it offline is the best way. So, you there?
I think you may have gone over this before, but can you go into again why Xbox emulation has been so elusive?
The question is, why has original Xbox emulation been so elusive? The answer to that is, it's because it got a really bad start, is the answer. So emulators were developed early on, but they were developed in a way that they weren't going to really be compatible with more than a handful of games. And it's more of a legacy thing than anything. It's just the way that the emulation was originally designed. But the good news is there are additional emulators that you can use today that are a lot better, and they're getting better, and it's not quite there yet. It's not, you know, the level of like Dolphin on the GameCube or anything, but it's definitely getting better. But it's going to take some time. The other thing is, with the original Xbox, there was a lot of complacency that went on at the time. A lot of people thought, oh, this is just a PC, you know, it's just a Windows machine. So we'll screw it. We'll just emulate it later. We'll figure it out later. But that's the wrong approach, as we've seen. It's very, very different than a PC in so many ways. The hardware is very different. It's very customized. So it was one of those kind of things where people just kind of sat back and just said, "Oh, we'll figure it out later," and here we are. So. Yes, and I can't really say anything more, but yes. There's been some development companies that have reached out asking different things, wanting different things, but yeah. I can't really say anything more than that, sorry.
Does piracy drive innovation, or is anti-piracy just the nature of the beast right now?
Does piracy drive innovation? Oh, man, you're asking good questions at the front there. I think so. I mean, I think it does. I think there's piracy where, you basically you're stealing, right? But there's also piracy for a reason. Like for example, if games have been delisted from like the eShop or the virtual console is no longer around, or you want to play WiiWare games, you can't do those things anymore. The only way you can do that is to download a ROM off the internet, which is illegal, right? I mean, by the law, by definition, it's not legal, and play it. So I think there's definitely, there's two sides to that for sure. But there's also the guy that has a PlayStation 4 with, 50 pirated games that he sells on eBay for like $400 or something, which I completely am against. That's not what I'm about at all, For me, if I'm going to go down that path of emulation and downloading things, it's because there's no other option. And it's almost like, sending a message to these game publishers to say, look, why did you take away the Wii Shop? Why did you take away, the virtual console? I mean, we really want those things and we want them back. And so I think that's where I kind of draw the line is the people out there that just, pirate stuff to make money is essentially what they're doing. So. You were back there in the red.
Excellent talk.
Thank you.
In the past, when we had classic consoles, we would have physical media, we'd have discs, cartridges, whatever. A legitimate reason to crack something might be for archival reasons. Do you see the end of being able to even create your own archives or keep things with the end of physical media now?
So the question is, are you asking if you think there will be an end to physical media at some point, or? Right. Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but I do think that physical media will start to get become less and less over time. I mean, we're already seeing it now. For the record, I love physical media. I mean, I'm a collector, so I like to get physical media as much as I can. And for the reasons why I also said, when things go away, I mean, I was at Pat NES Punk's talk before. They were talking about DuckTales. Right, which just got pulled, right, from the Capcom. They removed it, so that's completely gone now. And that was only out for, 6 years, and they removed the game. So, so I do think that physical media is becoming less and less over time, which is very unfortunate. Will there ever be an end to it? I don't think so. I mean, I think physical media will always exist, but I do think that slowly over time, it's definitely going to start going away, unfortunately. I mean, I hope it doesn't, but... it just seems to be the way it's going. So, any other questions? You there?
Have you ever noticed any companies trying to stop people from loading games from like hard drives? So, like on the PS2 and the Dreamcast,
mm-hmm.
like you could basically put a hard drive in it and like you could play your ROMs on it and play your games off of it. Have you ever noticed like any other companies trying to stop that?
Yeah, so the question was, when you play games off a hard drive on a modded system, have you noticed any game companies kind of checking for that? I will tell you that on the OG Xbox, I've never seen that happen, but I think on the PlayStation 2, there's definitely examples of that happening in the past. I will need to, dig up some research and find out more about it, but I have heard stories about that. I mean, it's another way where the developers or the game companies are checking for, a legal copy of the game. If it's running on media it's not supposed to be, then they'll definitely do that. Like on the PlayStation 2, There is a media check, is another form of protection I didn't really talk about, but you know, PlayStation 2 games, they come on DVDs and they come on CDs, and there is a check in place to see if it's coming on a DVD, but not a DVD plus R or a minus R. In other words, not a writable DVD, but just on a regular DVD. So there are some things that happen there, but as far as hard drives, I need to kind of dig up a little more info on that, I think, is my answer there. You there.
In terms of the Diablo source code that was reverse engineered,
yep.
How do they know that that's actually like the actual source code? Is there any comments in there? I don't know if you've seen, like, they started reverse engineering Super Mario 64.
Mm-hmm.
They released, they said they were only 60% done with it. But do they know, is that the actual real authentic source code, or was it their recreation?
So the question was the Diablo, the game that I released on the Switch was based on reverse engineered source code, and was it the actual source code or, you know, their interpretation of it? The answer to that is, initially what I had read and what I learned was that the person that had reverse engineered it did it all himself, but I found out later that actually there is some ties to the original source code from that game. But I don't know too much more about it. Like, there were rumors going around that, I'm not saying it was stolen or anything like that, but it seems a little more, you know, it seems like it more than a coincidence that code runs exactly the same way as Diablo does. Because if you're going to reverse engineer something, there's always going to be some differences here and there. But a lot of people have questions about, well, this plays exactly the same, and how is that possible? You know, so I guess my answer to that is, I don't know. You know, there's probably more to come there. But on the flip side, that Diablo source code has been around for, it's 4 years old now. It's not new. It's not something that's just been released. So then why hasn't Activision come after these people? You know, because I mean, I think if Activision was very concerned about it, they would have taken down the GitHub page pretty much the next day. So I'm not sure about that one. That's definitely in the I'm not sure basket at this time. So, any more questions?
Yeah. So earlier you mentioned that the Dreamcast and the GameCube, the discs were not readable in a PC CD-ROM drive, correct?
Yep.
So, if it's not crossing any lines for me to ask, how is it possible to actually dump the data off of the discs?
That's a great question. Probably something I could have added in the slide deck. Maybe I'll do it for the next presentation. But so when the GameCube came out, the broadband adapter and Phantasy Star Online. So with a copy of Phantasy Star Online, what you could do was you could change the IP address to point to your PC, which was running a dumper program. So essentially, this dumper program would just dump the contents of the disk, and that's how you would rip the game. So in the early days before mod chips, with a copy of Phantasy Star Online, that's how they would rip discs before mod chips came out. And then the mod chips came out, and then of course you can use a mod chip to play your games that way. But and the same way with the Dreamcast, the broadband adapter was very, very similar. Once you know, they figured how to do that with the broadband adapter, or even with a serial cable, like you could connect up a serial cable to a PC and rip the game. And these release groups would literally take all night ripping a game over serial, you know, 56K, whatever it was, right? But that's what they would do. I mean, getting a game ripped from a disc, there's so many different ways to do it. And it's not just, you know, modding the system in order to get there or using, you know, tools like that. Many times you would just use a network to get the game off the disc.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions? You there.
Drive emulations like mm-hmm. GDEMU for Dreamcast. Is that, you know, technically possible for other consoles like PS1 or PS2? Like, would that be able to, like, get that?
Yeah, so the question is, many systems have the drive emulators, and is it possible for, like, the PS1 to have one?
Yeah.
Or other systems? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In fact, we seem to be going in that direction right now. There's a lot of, you know, optical drive emulators that are out for different systems. I mean, obviously the 16-bit stuff, you know, the PC Engine and the Mega CD just came out with one. The Dreamcast has the GDMU stuff. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that's the future, in my opinion, of these old systems and keeping them going is these kind of drive emulators. The PlayStation 1 has the PSIO, I think, is what it's called. I'm sure there's others in development for other systems right now. You know, once the Sega Saturn, that mod becomes more, mainstream, I'm sure there's going to be something coming out for that as well. And I know there's things that have already been released for that. So, yeah, I mean, I think in general, any system out there will have, its optical drive emulation at some point. I mean, it's obviously more complex to do in systems and others, but it's definitely something that's definitely a thing for sure. I'm going to play a game, do I play on an emulator or original hardware? Most of the time it's going to be original hardware, but sometimes I've used emulation for sure. Like I said, you said mature emulators like Dolphin is considered probably one of the best ones you can get. I would say 90% of the time I'm using original hardware, but also, I mean, if it's a pain to set up the original hardware, if it's kind of been sitting in my closet for the last, 12 months and I've got to pull it out, I may just use an emulator at that point. I don't really have a huge preference there, but it's going to be OG hardware most of the time for sure.
I'm not sure if this is kind of like related at all to like co-working, but I'm just curious on the subject of ROMs. Do you know like how most people extract the ROMs from the games?
How to extract ROMs from the games?
Yeah, do you know how most people do that? There's
different ways to do things. It's a very open question, but I mentioned freezer cartridges. That was one way that they used to rip games. Back in the Super Nintendo days, they would use the discs, the Super Wildcard discs, so they would just rip the discs at that point. These days, I mean, you can use... there's pretty easy ROM dumping tools out there now for a majority of systems. So you can get ROM dumpers that will extract Genesis, Super Nintendo, NES, PC Engine. The disc-based stuff, we talked about just now, there's many, many different ways to rip games from discs these days. So it's pretty simple to do. The ones that are a little trickier are the floppy disc stuff, with the, like I said, if there's a hole punched in the disc, ripping one of those discs is a little trickier, and that's when you sometimes have to resort to like a cracked version of the game or a copied version in order to use that. Got about 4 minutes to go. Any other final questions? You there?
Going back into the emulation of Polymega, can you give us any insight into that? And again, going back to the convenience factor, yep. Where potentially just
The question is about the Polymega, which is the kind of the all-in-one system that's got the Nintendo, Super Nintendo, all the different systems in one system. I was actually at E3 last month, and I got to play it out firsthand. I was impressed, honestly. And I know Bob from RGB Rob's there. He's played around with one as well. I was a skeptic about the system. I didn't really think it was going to be that good. I thought it was just another emulation box, which is not a bad thing, but it's not really anything different than just building your own system, like a Raspberry Pi type emulation setup. But I got to play around with it, and I was pretty impressed with it, to be honest. Like, it played Sega Saturn games very, very well, a lot better than I thought it would. And Saturn emulation's always been a little, a little weird sometimes, and it's always been slow, and there's always been issues. But you can tell they've put a lot of attention and care into this one, so I've pre-ordered one, so I'll be checking it out for sure. You there? I would probably wait till the service is down. It's funny you mentioned the Wii U because they just brought a firmware update like 2 weeks ago. I mean, why? I would probably just hold off just a little longer. I mean, I'd probably wait till like next year and do it. I've modded mine though, by the way. But yeah, the Wii U is interesting because, for all intents and purposes, it's a dead system. But for some reason, they keep bringing out these little updates for it, and I can only assume they're trying to, patch out the modding stuff that's going on. But as of the last update, you can still mod your Wii U very, very easily. Yep. They did, yeah. And I thought so he said that Sony did it with the Vita, and they did. And I thought that Nintendo would do the same, but you can still mod your Wii U pretty easily. Any more questions? 2 minutes to go. You there.
Do you think copy protection is a little bit easier to crack now with, you know, all the consoles being stronger, but also the better tools that we have, like better computers, and since a lot of physical media, like with Nintendo, the copy protection is like on the chip?
Yes. The question is copy protection easier to defeat now? I mean, if we're talking about retro, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot easier tools out there. I mentioned those freezer cartridges. I mean, you can get an emulator and just emulate a freezer cartridge. I mean, you don't even need some of this old hardware that the old school people used to use back in the day. There's easy ways to rip things and crack things these days. There's some pretty sophisticated tools out there that you can use. So absolutely, absolutely. The question is, what's the motivation for release groups? It's a really good question, man. I'm glad you asked it. So for me, the motivation is I like messing around with stuff. That's what I like to do, right? But that's not necessarily the same as the release groups. The release groups did it to beat the other guy. They did it for the e-credits or the respect or the bragging rights or, you know, putting their logo on the game before the competition, right? So that's why they were doing stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Most of these, you know, groups that released these ISO groups were just kind of teenage kids, lot younger that were really, really smart with computers and knew how to crack games and stuff like that. So different motivation there for sure. Well, it's 5:00. Thank you so much for the panel, and hopefully I'll be back next year. But thanks again, everyone.